welcome to episode 22 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon IT scandal for Computer Weekly back in 2009.
Hello, my name is Nick Wallace and I am the author of the book, The Great Post Office Scandal. Together, Rebecca and I are covering phase two of Sir Wynne Williams' Post Office Horizon IT public inquiry at the International Dispute Resolution Centre in London.
If you don't know anything about the wider story, you can still read my original investigation, or you can read Nick's book, or you can listen to the last episode of this podcast, because today we are going to dive straight into inquiry stuff.
Yes, episode 21 had a rather pedestrian explainer at the top of the episode, didn't it?
But a quick rundown.
It does the job. But if you've never come across this before, episode 21 is a good place to start.
Yeah, the first couple of minutes. But very basically, the post office prosecuted hundreds of innocent people on the basis of accounting data drawn from its very shaky IT system.
And phase two of this statutory inquiry here at the IDRC is looking at how the disastrous Horizon system was rolled out into the post office network when it wasn't really very stable. The system was originally called Pathway, and it was designed, built and maintained by Fujitsu UK, which in the late 90s was known as ICL, the British company Fujitsu eventually swallowed. Today at the inquiry, we heard from Dave McDonnell and Jan Holmes, authors of an internal Fujitsu ICL Pathway Task Force report, which was convened in 1998 to try to understand why their system didn't work very well.
It concluded with one of the best quotes from the inquiry so far, phase two. Whoever wrote this code clearly has no understanding of elementary mathematics or the most basic rules of programming.
So we were rather looking forward to what the authors had to say to spell out why they came to those conclusions. And I think Dave McDonnell was perhaps the most important witness so far in this entire inquiry. Over the course of 3 hours, McDonnell, who was a former deputy development manager at the front end of the Horizon IT system, known as EPOS, alleged that Fujitsu knowingly rolled out a system that didn't work. McDonnell said he told them it didn't work and told them that EPOS, which stands for Electronic Point of Sale, the EPOS cash account, needed to be rewritten. Fujitsu decided they would rather instead continue to make repairs on the fly. And a year after that report, after the entire system had been accepted by the post office, Horizon still didn't work and Fujitsu knew it. But in November 1999, they took the internal decision to try to keep Horizon from falling over through maintenance rather than Jan Holmes' recommendation, which was to revisit the decision not to rewrite the cash account code. Hopefully that is making sense. Dave McDonnell said he told anyone who would listen, including his bosses Terry Austin and Chris Humphreys, and, you'll never guess, Gareth Jenkins, chief architect of the Horizon system. So this is a longish clip that I'm about to play you, but in it, McDonnell names names and explains exactly where Fujitsu went wrong. And the questions here are coming from Jason Beer, KC, who's the lead barrister to the inquiry.
You say in paragraph 22, I reported my conclusions to the following people. Steve Warwick, who ducked and dived and swerved the issue. What do you mean by that?
Steve was very pro. We've done everything right and there's nothing wrong. He was in that camp. And the code's in good enough condition to be able to go live. So by then, I was just making noise to all of these people. They'd already decided that it wasn't going to get wholly or partly rewritten. And that's an important phrase, which we should come to in a minute. But Steve was firmly in the camp of, we're not rewriting it, it's okay as it is. Chris Humphreys agreed he could see the problem and he did try very hard to effect change, but he was under Terry Austin and he didn't on his own have the political sway to be able to persuade the higher echelons to, you know, bite the bullet and rewrite the cash account.
And so he actually refused Mr. Austin for the cash account to be rewritten?
Yeah. Terry Austin did. He disagreed with me. And
you say that Gareth Jenkins denied the issues point blank and ran off to hide in Bracknell and avoided contact with the team. In what way did he deny the issues?
Well, we managed to get Gareth down to the counter team, I think, twice that I can recollect. And we tried to engage him in the conversation about the missing API, which he was very defensive of, and said, no, there's nothing wrong with it as it is. And we also try to, I also try to engage him to get him to lend his political design weight behind the argument that at least the cash account should be rewritten, if not the whole thing. And I was unable to get him to engage on our side to lend his persuasive weight to persuade Terry Austin to rewrite the cash account. When we started having conversations like that, that's when he kind of became evasive, certainly with me. I was never able to get him to come back down to on site again after that.
Now, just to pick up on that, the mention of Gareth Jenkins by Dave McDonnell here is mind-boggling. This was the Horizon System architect, a man who the Post Office went on to use as an independent expert witness in the criminal prosecution of sub-postmasters. So the system was his baby, and here is Dave McDonnell suggesting he was an inept, absent father.
Did Mr. McDonnell have more to say?
Oh, yes, he did. We're not quite in the pantomime season yet, but oh, yes, he did. Lots. He took issue with the idea propagated by other Fujitsu witnesses to the inquiry, who seemed to be claiming that his preferred solution, rewriting the Horizon cash account, was somehow too onerous to contemplate. Jason Beer started by reading out the relevant section of McDonald's witness statement.
In the list of things that you thought needed to be done was total or partial rewrite of the cash account at the top of it.
So that phrase that we've used in the document that Jan and I authored, we recommended that it should be rewritten in part or in whole. And this is a key phrase because although it's not as clearly written in the document as it could have or should have been, maybe, it was certainly, those conversations and emails were certainly taking place within the project with the likes of Chris Humphreys, the test team, Terry Austin, everybody, that in part meant we should at least rewrite the cash account because in my view, this was primarily a financial accounting system at the end of the day. If the system blue screened or you couldn't sell a stamp on a Tuesday or whatever it was, that's an inconvenience, but at least financially it's correct. So my recommendation and those of the senior members which we spoke about earlier was the cash account must be written at least, rewritten at least. That's the in part of that phrase.
And so was that, in answer to my question, the top of your list?
Yes, that was the number one thing that needed to be done.
Can we go forward to paragraph 41, please, of your witness statement, which is on page 13? And in paragraph 41, you say, I've observed several witness testimonies referring to proposed rewrite as a big deal, a big job that could potentially introduce more problems than it would fix. This was not necessarily true and indicates either a basic misunderstanding of how the EPOS system was built or even potentially suggests an attempt to obfuscate the issue. The EPOS system was modular, and what the other engineers and I was proposing as an immediate action was a rewrite of only the cash account model. It would have been possible to write a new second version of this module alone, leaving all of the other code untouched. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, so what quickly happened was it was very clear that they took this report and part of their defence or argument to reject the recommendations that we made was to forget the first part of the sentence where we recommended to rewrite it in part, referring to the cash account, and they focused on rewrite the EPOS counter system as a whole. And every conversation that was had after that, and certainly I heard in the testimonies, were conflating the whole proposal to rewrite some of the product into it's too big, it's far too dangerous, it'll introduce more problems. When in fact, if you understood that it was built out of Lego bricks, you could replace the Lego bricks one at a time, starting with the most critical, the most important, which I would argue was the cash account. And here, you could even, because it was a batch process that wasn't part of the counter-client-customer interaction, you could rewrite that as a separate module and have it running as a shadow process on the counter. You could run the cash account twice at the end of the day or whenever, as a secondary confirmation and use the replacement module to check the validity of the first one. And once you'd proved that it worked, you could take the old one out and just continue with the new one. And this was not a large task. It was not something that... I couldn't understand why they didn't do it, because it was such a... It's not a small piece of work, but relatively small, and you could have done it without introducing any danger to anything else on the counter.
So after this, we got taken to a memo, which was only produced to the inquiry by Fujitsu yesterday. The memo looked at all the problems with Horizon and concluded that rewriting the cash account was the riskiest thing to do, with the least possible benefit. McDonnell was left shaking his head at all this.
On that highlighted line, when I first saw this document this morning, my initial impression was that I'd got my understanding of positive and negative the wrong way around, because they are inverse to what I would have said.
So the benefit would have been high, the do nothing risk would have been high.
Yeah.
The destabilisation, yeah, migration and cost risk would have been low.
Correct.
They should all be the other way around.
Yes.
Moving down the page, there's then a score essentially given, and rewriting the cash account comes out as bottom. Do you agree with that assessment and approach?
I don't understand it. It's upside down. I've no idea how you could ever come up with such a ridiculous scoring system and end up with the cash account being at the bottom by quite a margin, yet you're talking about a financial accounting system that clearly doesn't work. It's beyond me. I think the project by then had, shortly after the cash account, the task force initiative and the subsequent recommendations that came out and the noise around it, there was a very definite project push to get the lid back onto that tin of worms and move on with acceptance in a positive way. And that did not include rewriting any of the code, as evidenced by this recommendation here. And so I think any dissenting voices were either sidelined or moved or ignored. And this was the narrative to move on through the acceptance process. So it doesn't surprise me that documents like this were created. But you know, as to why, I can only imagine.
Can I just unpick that a little bit so I understand it? You're saying that it doesn't surprise you that a document like this was written, because at this stage of the process, the prevailing narrative was to move on, get the project rolled out, and therefore rewriting the cash account was not on the cards, and you couldn't write a document that said we need to rewrite the cash account.
Correct.
McDonnell finished his evidence by telling the inquiry that he was offered his boss's job by Terry Austin. He provisionally accepted, but only if the cash account was rewritten. The offer was rescinded, and he was sent to work on another project.
This seems quite huge, and I can't help thinking that Terry Austin potentially should be recalled by the inquiry.
Well, you're not the only person to think that. I immediately thought that when I was listening to Dave McDonald's evidence, and another person, after we came out of McDonald's session, said, "Do you think Terry Austin will be coming back?" And I'm, yes, probably. So we'll see whether or not that happens. The inquiry has the power to recall any witnesses, so it may be that Terry Austin gets another bite of the cherry, because none of this stuff came up when he was giving oral evidence.
No, it didn't.
Oh, and also I just want to point out that Sir Wynne Williams, the inquiry chair, demanded a witness statement from Fujitsu explaining how and why a document of direct relevance to the subject matter that Dave McDonnell was talking about should suddenly appear the day before he was due to give evidence. So while we were digesting what Dave McDonald said, you were keeping an eye on Jan Holmes's evidence, the afternoon witness today.
Yes, so Jan Holmes co-authored the task force document with Dave McDonald, which recommended rewriting the cash account. But today the inquiry was a little more focused on his role in providing audit data for the post office. So one of his responsibilities was providing this audit data as and when the post office needed it. And he described being surprised in 2000 by a huge jump in the number of requests for audit data from the national security team, or in his words, a group of people we'd never heard of before. So he described it as going from around 10 to 20 requests a year for audit data to between 100 and 200.
In my role as pulling audit data for prosecution support, I had no idea or no knowledge at all of what level of underlying fraud was going on within the post office. I'm sure there was a level. There must be in a network that large with that many people. But how then that number would suddenly jump to 1 to 200 potential investigations a year, I just don't know. I mean, it sort of wasn't our job to query that with the post office. I would have expected them to have queried that themselves to try and understand better why there was this upsurge in perceived bad activity.
Did you ever have a discussion with the post office as to why there was this sudden increase?
No, and that's I suppose perhaps where we could have done a bit more to question the increase. I would have half expected them to do their own investigation into that matter, not rely on others to say, why have you got this increase in numbers?
That was Jan Holmes.
Really interesting, isn't it? Because we've often had this debate, everyone's been asking this question around the Post Office Horizon IT scandal, which was, why did the number of prosecutions suddenly leap when Horizon was rolled out? And my answer has always been it was a cultural thing, that Horizon was shining or opening a window onto the perceived criminality in the post office network. And obviously it was something that was concerning Fujitsu as well at their end. Why are we suddenly getting all these requests?
Yeah, although he did admit that they perhaps should have done more to investigate why there was this big jump. He kind of put it on them to do it, but he did admit when he was giving evidence that perhaps ICL or Fujitsu could have done more to try and understand where these were coming from and why it leapt up.
It is a theme, isn't it, in this whole inquiry. There seems to be a lack of curiosity both at the post office techie end and the Fujitsu ICL end at where this audit data was going and how it was being used for prosecutions and what people were actually being prosecuted for. But you hope that the inquiry is going to look into this a lot more going forward.
As much as they can, although they constantly seem to expect somebody else should be doing it, and when they're asked who should be doing it, they don't know. So it's a challenge for the inquiry. Was there anything else, Nick?
Well, we've got yesterday's witnesses, and I spent a lot of time listening to Bob Booth, who was the acceptance test manager at the post office, and like his boss, Jeremy Folks, who gave evidence last week, he said one of the biggest problems for the post office before the Horizon Pathway rollout was that they had no real idea at a basic coding level what sort of system they were buying from Fujitsu. And this, from Bob's perspective, wasn't just about the terms of the PFI contract between Fujitsu ICL and the post office, but the corporate culture. Here, he told the inquiry that even before Fujitsu ICL won the contract, they weren't very good at engaging with even potential clients.
I think they were more defensive of their solution and didn't want to listen to the complexity. They had a more of a fixed world view about, this is the solution we're proposing, it will work. The other providers were more structured and more amenable to listening and to understanding why we were trying to say, have you thought about? Because ultimately, the service provider solution was their solution. We were not designing it. We were not going to be responsible for it. It was the service provider's call about how they did things. All we could do is try and highlight that walking over glass in bare feet wouldn't be a good idea. Maybe you should get some flip-flops if you thought about it, and trying to highlight those kind of things to them. We did have one meeting where the owner, chief, I think probably the owner of Escher, who were providing a key component, came in. He was much more technically aware of the system, it being his underlying software that would be being used. His view was much more that technology could solve it if you threw more technology at it. The ICL Pathway people were more aware of the business implications and were building a solution to a price.
So that was Bob Booth giving evidence there. Now, in the afternoon, Post Office project manager John Marr gave evidence to the inquiry, and you had a look at that. So what did he have to say, Rebecca?
He had quite a lot to say. So he criticised the lack of transparency from ICL Pathway during the late 90s and said that he suspected that the reason for this was the fact that there was no written design for the software. He was not aware of ICL's EPOS task force, which was convened to solve the multiple problems with Horizon, or of ICL employees' recommendations to rewrite the EPOS software. And he said that knowing one of those things would have given the post office team more leverage to press for a change of approach when it came to EPOS. He also said that the post office, to his knowledge, took no steps to address this lack of transparency when they were renegotiating the contract. And he also outed himself as one of the few inquiry witnesses to have admitted to reading my 2009 Computer Weekly article.
At last.
At last. I'm so excited. Which told of the distress of some of the postmasters that we've heard from. But he also said when he was questioned by one of the postmaster's barristers that he did not publicly speak out about what he knew about the system because he felt he had nothing to offer. Which I thought was interesting, because if someone like him had got in touch with me or you or Carl at Computer Weekly, he absolutely would have had a huge amount to offer, even if he'd wanted to stay anonymous.
This goes down to a sort of ignorance of the way that journalism works, and that's not anyone's fault but the journalism profession. We need to make it easier for people to recognise that if they reach outside of their organisation to a journalist, that journalist is not immediately going to broadcast everything that they've just told them on the phone. They're going to have confidential meetings with them, and they're going to work with them and talk through the possibility of A, how newsworthy what they have to say is, and how comfortable they might be about ever publishing it in future. And I do think, and I've seen this a few times now, where people who have really important information sit on it because they don't think it's their role to go outside their organisation. But the moment someone comes and asks them for it, like an inquiry or a police investigation or something formal like that, they'll volunteer it, but they don't see why or how they could volunteer it themselves, thinking that, oh, of course people will come and get me if they need me. But otherwise, it's a really weird thing that it's wrong to put your hand up, because you could be, I suppose you could be exposing yourself in some way. You could get yourself into trouble. But if an authority comes to you and asks for information. But unfortunately, what it does is it people think that the authorities have more competence and knowledge than they actually do. They don't. The authorities don't. This inquiry does not know what people know. Mm. It's busy trying to find it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't know to suddenly go and pick up the phone and get hold of the most interesting person. Also, it doesn't often know how to find people. Mm. So it's a really interesting psychological thing that people don't put their hands up for various reasons, but I think actually sometimes they're the wrong reasons. And that's not sort of, they're being disingenuous or acting in bad faith. They just simply don't understand the way this kind of process works, because obviously they've never had to go through it before.
And it's potentially related to culture of whistleblowing as well, and how people are encouraged to do that and how comfortable they feel doing that. But all of which to say, if you two are project managing... an IT system that's ruining people's lives, do let us know, because we wouldn't publish anything that you weren't comfortable with anyway.
Exactly. So. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you and I have dealt with really, really sensitive, traumatised people who contact us. And as a journalist, you have a duty of care to them.
Mm-hmm.
And also sometimes you just have to turn around to them and say, look, I think you're better off going to the police, or look, I think you're better off speaking to your manager about this, or a lawyer. This isn't really a story.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, this is something different. So it's what we need to get across and get over to, and we, I say we as a journalism profession, need to get across the way that we operate, the way that we function, which is that, you know, we have a code and a way of dealing with system, which dealing with people, which is a system which protects them and it protects us. You know, we have to be responsible in the way that we go about things. And people assume the worst about journalists because they assume irresponsibility, which, you know, there have been occasions when people have been let down by journalists, but they are very, very much the exception.
They are. So Marr revealed that everyone working on the Horizon project in February 1999 knew that the system had problems balancing its cash account and told Sam Stevens, one of the inquiry barristers, that around the same time he voted in a meeting to cancel the project, describing it as a death march, and this is why.
Well, I thought it was what I think is called the sunk cost fallacy, which is that you continue to pour effort into something that's inevitably failing, and instead of being able to cut your losses, you end up losing everything. I felt we were on a death march. I didn't see it ending well. I'd seen the benefits agency exit. I thought there were better ways to do this, and definitely not the way we were doing it.
I think you used the words, you were on a death march. To what extent did you have any confidence in ICL Pathways' ability to improve the situation to a level which would be satisfactory for acceptance at this stage?
Well, it was going to be difficult. I mean, one assumed that they'd get over the line in some way at some stage. The question was when and at what cost.
Yet by September the same year, Ma had changed his mind, and despite the Horizon system not meeting the post office acceptance criteria, he decided to vote to accept the Horizon system, albeit with some caveats.
If you didn't think that it satisfied the criteria for acceptance, why did you think that conditional acceptance was appropriate?
Because I thought it was inevitable. I mean, I thought the post office had already thrown in the towel by increasing the threshold in one of the previous contract negotiations, and that it was going to happen. I didn't think acceptance would stop Horizon going live.
What did you consider of the robustness of the system at this point?
I thought it was delicate.
Did you consider it to be robust?
No, but I wouldn't have considered anything robust at that stage anyway, because I think, you know, robustness is something that would have to be proven over a longer period of time, and it was a small number of outlets that were out there, etc. I thought robustness is something that would have to be built up. I didn't think it was robust, but I wouldn't have put that premature on anything at that stage.
Finally, Ma was taken by Sam Stevens to the last part of his witness statement, where the issue of prosecuting sub-postmasters with Horizon data was raised.
You say here that acceptance was a prescribed contractual event. It served its purpose, but it did not mean that the solution was reliable and robust. From my experience, care and serious attention would need to continue to have been applied to the system as it moved through rollout and beyond. Years later, when I learned that Post Office had prosecuted multiple sub-postmasters based on assurances from Fujitsu that no explanation other than fraud was possible, I was shocked. Shocked because, amongst other things, Post Office would appear to have completely changed its view of Horizon since the time up to 2000 while I worked on the project. That point, Post Office would appear to have completely changed its view since you worked on the project. Please, could you expand on what you considered the general Post Office view of Horizon to be at the point you left the project?
It was viewed as delicate. That's how I viewed it. No one could have continued in that period after that I left and not been involved in multiple rectification activity. It did not present itself as a stable system. All, you know, there may have been three high-level acceptance incidents, but there were multiple causes for those.
So if someone had said to you in 2000 that the Post Office planned to investigate sub-postmasters for fraud and false accounting based on data produced from Horizon, what would you have said?
But I don't think it even did base it on data from Horizon. It based it on assurances from Fujitsu staff, which would have shocked me even more.
That was John Maher being questioned by Sam Stevens. Carl Flinders has written up Maher's evidence for Computer Weekly, focusing on the same idea that the Horizon project was too big to can, despite all the concerns about whether or not it was capable of working.
I just thought it was really interesting reviewing the witness evidence from yesterday compared to what it was today. They're like two sides of the same coin, aren't they? The post office people having no visibility of what was going on, and Dave McDonnell essentially saying for the first time in public exactly what was going on inside Horizon. And the story wasn't good. So all the post office's suspicions were essentially correct, but they just didn't have the visibility of how bad this project was.
Yeah, exactly. Your book is out this week, isn't it? Your paperback.
How kind of you to mention that. Yes, so forgive me for plugging it. It is the paper. I know I've mentioned this on the last couple of podcasts, but I am grateful for your indulgence. If you haven't heard before, the paperback version of The Great Post Office Scandal is coming out this week. It's updated to bring you everything that's happened over the past year. It's only £13.99. If you order it right now from Bath Publishing, and I will put the link in the description to this podcast, you'll get free postage and packing, and it will be available from all good online bookshops from tomorrow, including Amazon and Waterstones. And I was going to say I brought a special copy in for you, but I forgot. I'm so sorry.
I really appreciate the thought.
That's inept of me. It was 5 o'clock in the morning when I left the house, and so I forgot to put one in my bag. I promise
you. I'm next very time excited.
Next time we get together to do a podcast, I will bring you a copy. Should you be bothered to
read
it?
Thanks very much. I certainly am. Please do buy it because it's really good.
And those two new chapters. Actually, one thing that we are doing, and I'm in tentative discussions with my publisher about this, if people have gone out of their way to buy a hardback copy of the book, which is significantly more expensive and obviously was more of a punt, I suppose, and it helped give us the impetus and the ability to invest in doing a paperback, then we'd be more than happy to send you a PDF of the final two chapters. There's no reason why anyone who's bought the hardback book should go out and buy another copy. So if you did buy the hardback book, do get in contact with me through the podcast or through the publishers directly, and I'm sure they'd be delighted to send you a PDF file on email.
Do you have anything else to plug?
I do have one more thing to plug. It's my final talk of the year this coming Monday evening. So that's Monday the 21st of November. I'll be at the Norwich Playhouse. If you want to see a presentation about the whole scandal from its origins all the way through to the present day, updated to include what's going on in the inquiry, and also perhaps get your new paperback book signed or your old hardback book if you want to bring it along, I would be delighted to meet you. And I'll put the link to the Norwich Playhouse box office in the description to this podcast again.
Finally, we ought to say that all our work on this podcast is crowdfunded, and if you would like to support our work directly, you can go to postofficescandal.uk/donate and make a small contribution, and you will be signed up to Nick's secret email, as well as funding our endeavours at this inquiry.
You said finally, but I also ought to draw everyone's attention to your Substack page as well. Rebecca Thompson, no P in Thompson, .substack.com, and you can read all of Rebecca's written musings on this scandal and anything else that takes your journalistic
anything
fancy.
Much less regular than your secret email, I must admit.
I know it's been quite a workload, this inquiry, and a learning curve for all of us, but we're going to keep plugging away, I think,
because
it's not fun listening to these sort of quite technical, detailed descriptions of disasters that ended up with people losing their livelihoods and the like, but we feel that what we're doing has got a point to it. So I suppose we'll carry on for as long as we can.
We absolutely will.
Cool. Well, thank you very much indeed for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe and follow this podcast so you can get each new episode for free as soon as it drops.
Investigating the Post Office Scandal is produced and presented by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace, with sage advice and support from Whistledown Productions. See you soon. Bye.
Take care.